Hello.
Hello, can you hear me? Yeah,
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me okay?
I can indeed. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm sorry I'm a bit late. It's been one of those nights.
Hello, this is James for the Badcast, and we're going to discuss the conflict between science and religion. In February 2007, National Geographic magazine published an interview with geneticist Francis Collins on a relatively common question for our day, namely, can science and religion ever be reconciled? Like most thinkers on the topic, Collins attempted to build a case for peaceful coexistence between the two fields. Indeed, many people even attempt to go so far as to meld science and religion together into a sort of symbiotic relationship where each one is enhanced by, or even dependent on, the other. Now, as someone who was raised in a Christian home, trained as an engineer, and currently works as a scientific researcher, I believe I can offer a unique perspective on this discussion. Specifically, I believe anyone who thinks they can reconcile science and religion has either failed to truly understand science or failed to truly understand religion. To see why this must be the case, let us consider Christianity. One of the foundational beliefs common to all sects of Christianity is the idea that Adam and Eve were literally the first man and woman to be created by God, and that all humanity springs from these two individuals. In related doctrine, the fall of man is the idea that Adam and Eve committed the first original sins against God, thereby dooming the rest of humanity, in some way or another, to a sinful life in need of redemption. So if there was no Adam and Eve, then there was no fall. And if there was no fall, there was no point in redemption. And if there is no point in redemption, then there is no need for a redeemer, and the very life of Jesus Christ himself loses all purpose. So how does such doctrine reconcile with the teachings of modern science? If one is going to accept the fruits of anthropology, evolutionary biology, and population genetics, several painful facts become apparent. For starters, the idea that two individuals could sire an entire race of 6 billion with massive genetic diversity over a time span of less than 10,000 years is, to put it mildly, laughable. Every scientific inquiry into the matter of humanity's origins unequivocally converges onto the idea that Homo sapiens evolved from large populations of hominids in Africa. Over the course of several tens of thousands of years, these hunter-gatherers migrated out of Africa into the greater parts of Eurasia and eventually America. Nowhere in this account is there any place for a seemingly paradisical garden or genetic bottleneck of two individuals. Science and Christianity are, at least on this issue, fundamentally at odds with one another. One simply cannot accept the teachings of one without contradicting the teachings of the other. Now, to be fair, many Christian apologetics do occasionally accept the fruits of anthropology, but usually can only do so by giving up any hope for literal interpretation of the creation stories given in Genesis. However, in so doing, they also give up a small piece of what was once traditionally the very cornerstone of their entire faith. In effect, it is nothing short of an open admission that science was right and the Bible was wrong. But it's worse than that. When placed under the scrutiny of scientific research, many more of the popular miracles and creation stories of virtually every other religion eventually faces the same conflict. If any of the stories are to be interpreted as depictions of real events that literally occurred, then modern science is intrinsically at odds with religion. At best, the only path to reconciliation is to demote scriptural events into the realm of metaphors and allegories that must be carefully interpreted and selectively accepted. That is to say, only religion gives way to science, but never the other way around. In the long run, however, this issue is only a symptom of a deeper rift between the two spheres. Even if religious believers could find a way to rationalize every apparent contradiction between scriptural events and scientific discovery, there is still a fundamental opposition to the way scientists and theologians investigate the world. In the realm of science, all ideas must be thoroughly tested and rigorously scrutinized before any hope of acceptance can ever materialize. And even then, every conclusion drawn, no matter how well supported, can only be accepted on a tentative basis, just in case newer and better ideas ever come along to refine our understanding. The very core of science is a mentality designed to seek out errors in our understanding and continuously refine it as we collect more data. Religion, on the other hand, has none of these features. Of all the religious denominations in all of human history, none have ever possessed a methodology for seeking out errors in a directed effort to correct them with new information. Almost universally, a religion can be very accurately described as a set of cultural ceremonies and dogmatic beliefs, typically revolving around issues like morality, afterlife, free will, consciousness, and deity. Without exception, all conclusions in these matters are intrinsically subjective in nature or supernatural in origin and never base themselves on any factual evidence. On the rare occasion that testable claims are ever made, for example, the idea that prayer can have tangible impacts on the health of hospital patients, these claims inevitably fail to produce the expected results. Worse yet, null results generally fail to have any impact on the convictions of the faithful because faith, by its very definition, is an unwavering conviction held in the absence of compelling physical evidence. So in a broader sense, science and religion may be thought of as methodologies for generating beliefs. Specifically, science is a methodology that relies on concepts like physical evidence, experimental reproducibility, and rigorous falsification, while religion relies on emotional convictions, subjective manifestations, social pressure, and cultural indoctrination. But if this were the end of the story, then science and religion would still be perfectly capable of peaceful coexistence. The reason science and religion keep butting heads is because emotional convictions and subjective manifestations are not only meaningless in scientific circles, but openly rejected. The very foundations upon which all religions are built are intrinsically antithetical to the very essence of scientific inquiry. For example, suppose I read my scriptures one day and come to the sudden realization that God loves me and Jesus Christ is my personal savior. In all probability, most Christians would necessarily conclude that I just experienced a form of divine communication. On the other hand, science would never allow me to conclude that any deity was actually communicating with me. This is not because science rejects the idea of God outright, but because psychological intrusions possess a demonstrable capacity for reproducing similar experiences on a regular basis. Without some kind of test, there is no way to tell the difference between real spiritual messages or the wild ravings of my own subconscious. Compounded with the sheer number of psychological intrusions that occur in human beings every day, science must necessarily conclude that my experience originated from a more earthly source. This is why science and religion will forever be in conflict. Science, as a matter of principle, cannot accept any propositions based on subjective evidence. This is not because scientists are unfeeling brutes, but because such experiences have a demonstrable power for leading men into false beliefs. By its very nature, science is an investigation into the true state of our external reality. Science takes every effort it can to avoid pitfalls in human thinking and zealously works to measure the distinction between correct ideas and false perceptions. Religion, on the other hand, is a set of cultural traditions and dogmatic assertions. Religion makes no effort to seek out flaws and correct errors because religion does not necessarily even care about the true state of reality. Personal comfort, social communion, and proselytism are all the admitted goals of religious efforts, while the objective search for truth and understanding is rarely, if ever, even on the list. Science and religion, therefore, cannot help but be forever in conflict because the very nature of religion itself is unscientific. The insertion of God into a scientific field has never furthered our understanding of anything and only has a track record of hindering the investigative process. So although religions may periodically acquiesce on specific conflicts in order to further their own goals, science never compromises on any of its conflicts with religious doctrine. There is only one truth, and the only goal of science is the steady convergence of our understanding towards that truth. So not only are science and religion doomed to a perpetual state of conflict, science cannot help but succeed in the end because the very nature of science is uncompromising. The more science expands itself into the mind of humanity, the more religion will be continually forced into ever greater degrees of obscurity and irrelevance. This has been James with the Badcast. For more scientific perspectives on religion, I encourage everyone to explore my YouTube channel, Anti-Citizen X.
This is forum member Catherine reporting for the Badcast. Today I'm going to explore cryptomnesia and confabulations. Two words guaranteed to raise your IQ by 5 points through mere utterance. Essentially, they are part of how our memories can trick us, whether through an eerie sense of deja vu, or memories of your past life as Napoleon. It is topical for me because my good friend recently forked out over £100 for past life regression therapy. And yes, we are still friends. The intention was that she'd be able to eliminate blockages from the past as a result of the therapy. However, the outcome of her session left me wondering if perhaps colonic irrigation wouldn't have made more of an impact. She was inspired by the story of a family friend who had a lifelong hysterical fear of fire, flames, candles, matches, all manner of pyro paraphernalia. After having regression therapy and working through her, wait for it, death by fire in a past life, she is now more comfortable around open flames, etc., which apparently is a good thing. Personally speaking, I must admit I have previously been curious about the concept of past lives myself, though I have stopped short of being regressed for fear that the hypnotist may try to cop a feel while I was in a vulnerable state. I have, however, been previously told, in some detail, about my past life as a high-class hooker by one reader. It is an uncomfortable reflection that the inspiration that popped into his head that day upon clapping eyes on me was sex worker. Anyway, thankfully in my friend's regression, no violations took place. In fact, altogether, it was a non-event. The crux of it was that she remembered nothing. When guided through the meditation and asked what impressions came to her, she drew a complete blank. The chap leading her session was shocked by this and suggested it was a rare occurrence indeed. So if she is the exception and not the rule, where do recollections of past lives come from? The source of these memories is most likely cryptamnesia and confabulations, our IQ-enhancing words of the day. Cryptamnesia is a memory bias whereby a person may falsely recall generating a thought, an idea, or a joke, and experience a memory as if it were a new inspiration. So all those times I think I'm being fabulously original and creative. Well, it's entirely possible I'm not. And confabulation is a fantasy that has unconsciously emerged as a factual account in memory. For example, my fleeting fling with David Beckham in 2007. Together these terms capture what is likely happening during past life regression, namely false memories that are born out of a combination of past experience, knowledge, and suggestion or guidance from the hypnotist. They are narratives created by the subconscious mind using imagination, forgotten information, and suggestions. In short, it is a mutually constructed delusion. Now, some may argue that this kind of regression is a relatively harmless undertaking. No harm, no foul. However, while some false memories may be innocuous, others can be damaging. They have the potential to increase a person's suffering and impact on relationships. And further, for those seeking reasoning or justification in past life experiences to make sense of their current life situation, well, frankly, it's a waste of time, energy, and potentially means accountability and responsibility for their behaviour is not taken. It has been found that a belief in reincarnation is the greatest predictor of whether a subject will have a past life memory while under past life regression hypnotherapy. And it has been demonstrated that a subject's expectations significantly affect the past life regressive session. So why the non-event in my friend's case? She is fully on board and subscribed to reincarnation. Perhaps my dire warnings of molestation and instruction to keep one eye open impacted on her ability to relax during the session. Or there is the more appealing option that she couldn't recall any past lives because she has none and isn't a particularly suggestible person. Certainly there is little proof of past lives that stands up to scrutiny. Most of the high-profile past life case studies that have been investigated revealed historical inaccuracies that are easily explained through a basic knowledge of history, elements of popular culture, or books that discuss historical events. The ITV series Have I Been Here Before?, hosted by Silver Fox Philip Schofield, did little to buck this trend, with the imagined lies reported by various celebrities failing to withstand fact-checking time and time again. Speaking of Have I Been Here Before?, cryptomnesia is also attributed as a possible cause of that bizarre feeling of déjà vu, the uncanny sense or illusion of having already seen or experienced something that is being experienced for the first time. Rather than evidence of time travel or turning into an alternate dimension, it is most likely a malfunction of memory, occurring because an original experience was neither fully attended to nor elaborately encoded in memory. So the present situation triggers the recollection of a fragment of your past. That spooky or uncanny feeling can be attributed to the fact that the memory is so fragmented that no strong connections can be made between the fragment and other memories. Further, the déjà vu experience may be due to having seen pictures or heard vivid stories from many years earlier. The experience may be part of the dim recollections of childhood, for example. Now, arguably, most educated folks have a good sense that memory and perception is subjective. It's the nature of being human. However, even a basic understanding of how false memories can be created and the process and function of memory helps lend weight to our war against woo and superstition. So my challenge to you as the week unfolds is to use cryptomnesia or confabulation seamlessly in a sentence. Go on, drop a C-bomb. This has been Catherine reporting for the Badcast.
My name's Patrick Redmond for the Badcast, and I'm talking to Colin Murphy from Pulse Project. Colin, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks, good. Colin, tell us what the Pulse Project is, what it's about.
Okay, the Pulse Project stands for Podcasting University Lectures and Science Education Project, and we originally wanted to see all the lectures that Oxford had to offer, but obviously time permitting we couldn't do that. But we were quite dismayed about the poor quality of videos that were available when they were put online. So we wanted to kind of just do high quality videos or podcasts and then make them available to the public for free and just produce them ourselves so that we'd feel that they were of high quality.
Okay, so how long has this project been going?
Oh my God, it's been going for about 4 years now, about 3 years of working on it, 2 years definitely having a web face.
Okay.
And trying to get people to get involved in it. It took us a while, a few problems initially with the web design, and now it's been running for 2 years solidly, gathering lectures.
So who is there apart from you? It's not just you running around all these lectures with your video camera and doing it all. Is there a group of you doing it all?
There's a group of us. I was very fortunate that somebody I worked with a few years ago was into making movies. He's a director, and he's done some very interesting things in the past. And when I was telling about my idea for Pulse Project, he said, well, I'll help you record the lectures. And that's Brendan Connolly. And he's been a huge support in making the videos and editing them and making them high quality. And the other director is Tudor Georgescu, who's into history of medicine and very different slant to what I'm interested in. I'm very interested in skepticism and science and popular science, and he's history of medicine.
Sure, I mean, I'm always trolling the internet for the Birmingham skeptics and the pub looking for possible speakers and things of interest, and I came across the Pulse Project, and it kind of grabbed my attention because on your front page you had the 1023 homeopathy. You had Richard Wiseman, you had Ben Goldacre, and the blog about climate change skepticism. And it was kind of like four very strong skeptical themes just leaping out at me, really, alongside all this very interesting science and not heavy lectures. What's the word I'm looking for? Not heavy. Informative. Just stuff that you wouldn't normally come across. And that kind of grabbed my attention. I thought that this was a very interesting looking project, really.
Thank you. Yeah, we try. We're still trying to get an overall. We might think of splitting it, maybe history of science on one side and science and popular science on the other, so people will be directed according to their interests, so that you would have the skeptics going towards one area. But we kind of like the eclectic mix of the heavy lectures. There was a lot in the past about eugenics.
Yeah, I noticed eugenics and euthanasia seem to be quite heavily represented on there. But yeah.
Well, that's Tudor's area, and he's wonderful with it. And he's prolific in. He's very young,
He makes PhD eugenics project. Enjoyable.
Yeah, oddly enough, he's amazing that he does. I've been captivated on many occasions with him shouting about eugenic movements in interwar Romania, and you're on his every word. It's quite shocking afterwards. He's not a supporter of eugenics before anybody thinks. He's a very good historian, but the way he's bringing it now, I think that he's getting more involved in the popular history of medicine stuff. There's a really strange podcast we have way back about a year ago on clothing as medicine.
Yeah, that's on your front page. Is one of your recommended by?
Oh, it's awesome. Steve King, who did that, just reeled it off as an idea for an area that people should be studying in, to a forum one day, and Tudor recorded it, and it comes together perfectly. It's a really clever little podcast.
I'll have a look at that.
Yeah, but that's what we wanted to do. These things are so missed. When I look at online, you see places like Oxford University and other that they let so many slip through the net. So many brilliant lectures. I think Simon Baron Cohen's been in through Oxford about 3 or 4 times. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to get him on, but he delivers great lectures, but they're just missed, and that's what we want to keep for 10 years' time.
Well, I think the thing is though, like, I mean, like, you're in Oxford and people in Oxford, and they miss lectures, and then for the rest of the world, us people out here, we've got no chance of seeing these things. And what you're doing is putting them out there, and everybody can just get them, download them, they're on iTunes.
Exactly. That's exactly what we want. And over the last few years, I've gotten more and more involved in skepticism, and I found that the skeptical circles are so warm, so willing to participate and to be recorded. And we decided to do all these interviews that we had that you mentioned. And what we're going to do with that as well is we're going to bring it together into a kind of documentary style. What is skepticism? So the first part of all the interviews we've done should blend together nicely into a quick short doc.
Come to Birmingham. Come and see us at Birmingham. We've got a great skeptics going at Birmingham. We've we've got the iPadio skeptics feed going, which is like something we're thinking of that possibly in the future we could be broadcasting out live over the net, doing all kinds of things. I mean, the possibilities are just out there to be exploited, really.
That's it. And doing it, we'd happily help. I think for the sake of a simple audio equipment and a lavalier mic, we could record your speakers and throw a bit of PowerPoints onto them and throw them up on Pulse Project as well, so that they're not missed. That's what we need to do for the people out there, is getting them involved and seeing what's available. And all my students love the interviews, the Ben Goldacre interview. Yeah. And Richard Wiseman. They love Richard Wiseman even more now when they've seen that he was on Derren Brown last week.
Sure. Yeah, he was. I mean, yeah, that's on tonight. I'll probably end up watching that on 4+1 because I think we might might end up missing the beginning. But anyway, that's right. By the by. Yeah, I mean, I felt a bit like I downloaded the lecture you've got on the Yeti. And I downloaded that and I started watching that, and I cracked open a beer, and I thought if I invited a few friends around, I would almost be having a bit of a lonely skeptics in the pub in the kitchen.
Like, oh, that's so in the kitchen
watching this woman who gave an excellent scientific analysis of the quest for the Yeti.
Isn't it amazing? She did a wonderful job with that. And I think it dragged a lot of people in who were probably less skeptical, probably thinking that there was actually a Yeti. I remember the audience, but they had a pleasant surprise, and her delivery was amazing. I really enjoyed that lecture. It's great to hear that you sat home with a beer watching, because that's what we want for this. This is why we designed this project, so that people would sit at home with a beer and enjoy some science.
What's the reaction you're having to it? Are you getting interest outside? What kind of feedback are you getting on the project?
We don't get as much feedback as you'd think. Everybody who sees it really likes it and really enjoys it and comes back for more. We get a lot of repeat visitors or repeat offenders, I suppose. We get a lot of people coming back seeing more. But I think I don't know whether people think we're bigger than we are or that we're doing more than we are, but they tend to leave us alone a lot more than you'd think. But when we do get an occasional email through, they're delighted. I remember mentioning to somebody that we mentioned them on one of our podcasts, and they tweeted that they were honored to be mentioned. I was thinking, my God, how big do they think we are? So we don't get as much feedback, but I think that's down to the fact that I haven't put the comment things on the podcasts. So I might do that in the future so that people can leave more feedback.
It's a big job producing this stuff, putting it on, and then marketing it must be another job in itself, really, thinking about all the different outlets and the organisations and the individuals that might be interested in this, and just trying to get word out there.
It is, yeah. I think for a while we weren't getting as much content. There was slow time periods where we weren't getting as much contact as content as we wanted. And so what I did is, it's now speeding up. My God, I've got more than I can actually put up. But what we are thinking about is marketing it to more to bigger newspapers like The Guardian and everything. Well, who've actually featured our 1023 video. Did you watch the 1023 video?
Yeah, I had a look at the 1023 video. It's our last talk we had with David Gregory. He did Birmingham Skeptics. He'd covered the Birmingham side of the 1023. So yeah, it was good. Your video is good.
Well, the amazing thing about it is what you won't get from the video is how disorganized it was. And Brendan is so absolutely amazing that he made it look coherent. And when I was watching it, and I watched it a few times, it was like another event that had happened. And I was thinking, how did he do this? How did he manage to time it, everything? And that's why we work with professionals.
Sure.
Because I've got a camera right at my knee here, but I would never put whatever I would record up on the Pulse Project website because it wouldn't be high enough quality. And it's once you get doing that, I think that's what we want to encourage people to do. We want to train people to be able to do this themselves, because the internet viewers are very, very critical, and they're not, and the YouTube video watchers, they don't like bad quality material.
No. And I was, the lectures that I've watched, I was impressed with the way you had the good angle, you had some good close-ups, and then you would cut into the slides of the presentations that they were doing just right at the right times, and it all hung together very well, and you felt as if you were there in the audience to some degree, which I thought was great. It was very engrossing.
Well, Brendan will love to hear that, and I absolutely agree. He is great at what he does, and it's great to hear that as well, because that'll inspire us to do more. We have a wonderful, we're moving towards a few documentaries that we're making at the moment, and that's why we've been kind of not updating the science lectures as much, because we're making these little things in the background, one on confirmation bias, which we're going to do on the Wasson card problem. So we're going to do that with students, because we've got these wonderful access to students at our school, and we're going to do a quick, about 3 or 4 minute video on confirmation bias, and we're going to do, I think, another one on the Barnum statements.
Okay,
we're going to do
a
nice little one of those, and getting the students that are doing critical thinking interested in it. I think that's where we want to go as well.
I mean, this is stuff that's got to, I mean, it's got to just blossom on the skeptical field, really, because the skeptics need not ammunition, but also resources, that's the word, need resources mm-hmm. that they can call on and say when they're in an argument, well, yeah, look, here's somebody who's done the experiment, and you can see it in, like, glorious video on YouTube, on iTunes, wherever you want to get it from, it's here. You know, what a great thing to have.
Yeah, no, there's great, I've been talking to a lot of skeptical people about an auction, and we're going to run an auction, a skeptical auction, basically, and we've got a couple of goodies. We've got Andy Nyman's given us a signed poster from his Ghost Stories play in the West End, and I think James Randi's posting us something over. I'm not sure what it is, but he's sending it over, and I think Michael Shermer's offered us a crate of skeptic magazines, so we're gonna gather more and auction all of these off to get money to make even more videos, so that we can have a lot of skeptical videos there.
Excellent. I think this is a good point to get a plug in for where people can find your videos and find you. If you want to just let people know now, because I haven't given you the opportunity to do that yet. We've mentioned you a lot, and they can Google, I'm sure, but if you want to just plug the website.
Absolutely. It's www.pulse-project.org, and you can do www.pulseproject.org, but I'm so used to doing the pulse-project. And you can also follow us on Twitter. So we're twitter.com/pulseproject. And I'll happily update people. And if people want to get involved with it by doing guest blogs, we're happy to, because that's one of the most important thing that we wanted to get across with our website, is that we will promote science and scientists. So if somebody wants to say something that they're doing, or really get involved and do a lecture, or even do a little interview with us, we'd happily do that with them. So we do want people to get involved. That's the main thing.
Fantastic.
And
we've just started off the Birmingham Skeptics. We've just started off our own blog site. We've just had the second blog posted up there. But we're having people doing guest blogs as well. So, I mean, why don't you do one for us, and asking people to get involved with the Pulse Project, or just drawing people's attention to it, and that might go around the Birmingham side.
That would be wonderful. I'll do it. Yeah, that, I would absolutely love to do that. You've got me recorded saying it. yeah, I'd love to do that. That's the one thing I found about skeptics and scientists is that they're a very warm bunch that are always constantly trying to encourage and help each other's causes or ideas. And that's great. You don't get that in many professions or organizations. It's really good.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that's partly why we give up so much of our time for doing these things, which frankly don't make us any money or I mean, they're just stuff that's good to do because you get a lot out of them and they're good fun. But I did really enjoy the lectures that I've looked at so far. I mean, there's so many there that I haven't had a chance to look at them all yet, obviously, but the ones that I cherry picked and picked out I really enjoyed, so I'll look at the other ones. And I just thought that there'd be a chance for profiling what you did here on the Badcast and out to the other skeptics in Birmingham and and give you a bit of airplay.
Thank you. Yeah, and one other thing was the Robin Dunbar and Marcus de Satoy lectures are wonderful and well worth a watch. And just the Marcus de Satoy lecture is our second ever recording lecture that we did. I think it was 8th of June 2008, I think it was, maybe even earlier. But it was done on handheld, so you can just see how wonderful Brendan is, because I forgot the tripod. And so we did it on his shoulder. Wow. And he did an amazing job of it, so excellent. We can't thank him enough.
Kudos to Brendan. Okay, well, we'll wrap it up there. I want to thank you for sparing the time to come and talk to me this evening. Well, you take care, Colin, and tell Brendan. Yeah,
thank you, Pat.
All right, mate.
I will indeed. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Conversation with My Sister by Romany. As a child, I lived in a small Welsh village called Pentyr. Pentyr, like most little Welsh villages, certainly had its fair share of places of worship, the Horeb, the Mission, and St. Catherine's Church in our case. During my childhood, our family never really ascribed to any particular or definite religious beliefs. I recall an incident when I asked my mother what religion I was. My mother responded by seeming to ponder for a moment and then saying, "Well, I suppose you'd be Church of England." Our beliefs were for the most part vague and loosely based around being a good person. Jesus and God were mentioned at times, usually with some reverence, but they didn't rule over us, as it were. I joined the Mission for a while simply because it backed onto a farm which sold freshly laid eggs and freshly made cream, which, if Mum was feeling flush, I could occasionally call in and buy on my way home, and because of their once yearly outings, which although were usually nothing more than picnics in local woods, were so exciting to me at the time. But it never lasted. I joined Sunday school at Horeb for a brief period, mainly because my friends went. They let you knock your age out on the pews while all the other children counted out loud on your birthday, and it was something to do on a Sunday. Also, they read you Bible stories and gave you a sweet or a lollipop afterwards if you'd listened well or answered questions correctly. But despite all these alluring qualities, my time with Horeb lasted about as long as my stint in Brownies did. That's to say, not very long at all. It's ironic, I suppose, that the one church I never attended was the one where I ended up getting married and where I had my children christened. Why? Well, it was without doubt the most aesthetically pleasing of the bunch, and I considered I had a loose connection with it through befriending an old lady early in my teens, whose husband was buried there. A loose and perhaps strange connection, yes, but I was a very impressionable teen. Funny, though, that I still have an affection for that church, even though I have very little religious beliefs these days. Nostalgia, I suppose. So where were my parents in all this? What were their thoughts on my chopping and changing churches? What were their thoughts on my attending any church at all? Certainly neither of them were churchgoers themselves. Did it annoy or upset them that I was trying these faiths out? The honest answer is I don't know. I can't recall any dramatic scenes of being forbidden to go. If anything, I remember Mum making sure I was clean before I left for Horeb. I think they viewed it as being somehow, again, very vaguely, good, that I was undoubtedly mixing with good people, and that no harm could come from it. That's the overwhelming view that seemed to encompass the churches specifically and religion as a whole. It was basically good. It could be argued that my parents were lazy about it, but I think my parents suffered from a limited view of religion, which never took into account the existence of any religion here in Britain, other than a basically Christian one. Could you call that ignorance? Probably. But what I really wanted to share with you is part of a conversation I had with my oldest sister in just this last week. The conversation began as blandly normal as most do. You know the sort of thing. How are you, the kids, the other half, the election, the weather, medical ailments. Unavoidable, I'm afraid. We are Welsh. Then, for reasons I forget, it turned to a recent family wedding at a gospel church. And for the first time in my life, I actually found the courage from somewhere to tell my sister that I no longer believe in God. So what's the big deal? You may well ask. Firstly, she's my oldest sister. For a great chunk of my life, I viewed her as almost a second mother, and it's probably fair to say that for much of my childhood, she played that role a great part. Secondly, I have such respect for her. Things have not been easy for her, and yet she's so positive and strong, and I truly respect her views. And thirdly, because it was the first time that I have ever made that admission out loud. Now, I realise that to many of you this will appear as utterly trivial. Not so to me. This hasn't been an easy journey. I have felt almost like a betrayer of my family's views, even though, as I have described, they were never very definite. My sister paused a moment on the other end of the phone, then asked me why I no longer believed. Truth is, I was so gobsmacked I'd actually said it, that I simply blustered something along the lines of, looking at things differently now I'm getting older, along with something about the hypocrisy of, in particular, the Catholic Church. I wonder now if I did that deliberately, because she immediately agreed, saying how corrupt that whole institution is, and so on and so on. I had effectively distracted her from my little announcement, and so avoided further explanation for it. It's not that I feel I'm wrong in my new standpoint, quite the opposite, actually. I'm far firmer on my doubts than I ever was in my faith. After all, I never once stood up and said, I believe in God. Why not? Perhaps because under the veneer of faith, which everyone seemed to grow up beneath, I'd always doubted. I wore a crucifix necklace for years, from when I was given a silver one for my 13th birthday, right up to about 3 years ago, when I found I could no longer do so without feeling like a huge hypocrite. I was bought a very pretty silver one with diamante stones for my 40th birthday just last year. I've worn it twice, but I'm hugely torn between needing to honour my newfound opinions and not wanting to offend the giver or hurt her feelings. She is quite a staunch Catholic, even though she herself professes to have lapsed, and is a close family member. I've called my point of view new several times, I notice. It's nothing of the sort, of course. It's simply a consolidation, at last, of a view I've been slowly coming round to for many years now. I have finally stopped ignoring it, and I'm trying to learn more about it. I suppose the point of my little confessional here today, if you'll pardon the pun, is that the one presiding emotion that has remained consistent throughout is confusion. I was confused as to what I should believe in or in which form I should believe it as a child. That confusion remained with me into adulthood, and now I'm confused over why I should feel guilt at daring to think differently. It's absurd. Surely by now I should feel able to express my views openly, no matter who is listening. The fact is, I do on almost every other subject, but religion carries with it its own set of taboos. It depends on them, I feel. I will continue my own personal struggle to find peace one way or another with my own outlook on life, and to try to remain at the same time respectful of the same in others, however they may differ from me. But that in itself is problematic, because some things should absolutely not be tolerated, however open-minded you may be.
You have been listening to The Badcast. To contact us, or to listen to past episodes, you can check out the website at www.badcast.co.uk. Thank you for listening. I'll leave you with an excellent song by the Vampire Vultures, called Sometimes. You can find out more about the Vampire Vultures by going to myspace.com/vampirevultures or searching for them on Facebook. Yes, give it to me, yes, yes, I like that, more, don't stop.